Hey everybody, welcome back to the Whiteboard Finance Show. This is our first episode ever with legendary Larry Ludwig. Some of you may not know him, he may not be a household name, but if you are a personal finance nerd, then I'm sure you've heard of his website, or former website, I should say, investorjunkie.com. Thank you for joining us, Larry. How are you doing?
Very good, Marco. How are you?
Good, thank you. So the point of this podcast, since you're the very first person on the show, I'm going to be a little bit rusty, and we did have some technical difficulties getting into the interview, so don't have a proper outline, but since I do know you for a couple years now, hopefully this will be a more candid type of podcast or conversation. If you don't mind, just introduce yourself, talk a little bit about how you started as an entrepreneur and how that ultimately gravitated towards starting a blog, Investor Junkie.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, you may have not even know this. So I started, in 1997, I think is the first time I started something part-time. So I had a web hosting business, web design firm, and was doing it part-time. So that was one of the original, I was one of the OGs as far as side hustles, and did it while I still had a full-time job. And, you know, grew that to a point where I was able to do it full-time, brought on other partners, went through multiple partners over those years, to make a long story short. Eventually bought out the last partner and did it for myself from about 2003-ish, 2004. And basically after about 5 years of doing it myself, got really tired with web development, web hosting, really realizing how much of a commodity it is, where everyone's expecting everything for, you know, I always joke as a price of a cup of coffee. And so I was looking for other opportunities. So I really looked at affiliate marketing, knew already affiliate marketing at some level with my web hosting business because I was selling other services through my own business, and realized, well, if it could be that profitable for my own web hosting business, which was generating about a third of the revenue, why can't I do it for, you know, another blog or create a blog by myself? Because I was creating blogs for others that were profitable. And I'm like, why can't I create my own business? And that's kind of where the proverbial light bulb went off in my head, that I liked personal finance, I liked investing, saw other successful blogs being sold. Bankaholic was the one I've referenced before that sold for about $12 million in 2009, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And just realized that was an opportunity for me. And it was done all through affiliate marketing in that guy's case. So why not create my own blog? I understood all the technology, I understood finance to a certain degree. Why not create my own? And I created Investor Junkie for that purpose.
That's great. So the people that don't understand affiliate marketing, do you want to dive into that very quickly, just understand or explain how that business model works?
Yeah, I mean, affiliate marketing is you're selling someone else's or promoting some other person's product, and you get commission per, unlike say ad banners, you get commission per sale. So you only get paid if there's a sale. If there's no sale, if the person clicks on a link, browses that product and doesn't sign up or buy that product, you get zero commission. So affiliate marketing is much different than ad banners, where ad banners you usually get per click. And so it's in some ways, it's almost treating like it's your own product. And that's kind of what my mentality was from the get-go, is treating affiliate marketing as if it was my own products, understanding, tracking, measuring of things. We can go over that in detail or not. But the goal was to really treat it as if it was my own products. But affiliate marketing, in the end, it's not your own product. You don't have any inventory. You don't have any, you know, customer service. You just pretty much on your end marketing or promoting a service, and you get paid for it if that person converts.
So in a way, you're almost like a commission salesperson. So you sell X amount of revenue and you get a percentage of that revenue. I know there's different types of models, but just for the beginners in the audience. Yeah, exactly. So
the thing that's interesting is, yeah, in my case too, I wrote a review and comparison tool. So the whole point was to really compare various investment services on Investor Junkie. And while one way we're getting paid, but the other hand, trying to also be impartial and say we discussed these various services. So I also even reviewed products and services that we got no affiliate commission for, and really made sure we were comprehensive. And that's more of a business decision. But we did the full gamut of, again, affiliate marketing. That's the only way we in fact made revenue. So we had no products or services of our own.
Interesting. So at its peak, what would you say some of the numbers were for Investor Junkie in terms of, you know, monthly traffic, you know, if you can get into revenue? I'm sure you have an NDA with who acquired the blog, but yeah. And if you want to talk about that, great. If not, no big deal. But what were some of the traffic numbers?
The traffic numbers I can disclose. The sales amounts or the income per month, I can't. But what I can say is, She said, revenue or traffic wise, we were generating about 250 to 300,000 unique page views a month at the, wow. At the peak. And where it came out to be a little over 3 million a year in traffic.
That's awesome. Was that mostly organic through SEO, search engine optimization, or was that through paid ads? How did that work?
Mostly through organic search. I would say 90 to 95% was from organic search. So we were a little high compared to other blogs out there, but almost all of the traffic was organic and grew literally from zero. So that's one of the things that's also fascinating, I'm sure, for most people, is how do you build a blog from literally zero? I didn't buy this site. I literally built it from scratch, registered it in December of 2009, and grew it to where it had 3 million per year in visitors. And that, you know, that's definitely something that's, you have to really understand how, you know, search engine optimization works. And that's a whole other, you know, topic into itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't want to get too down the rabbit hole because this podcast is going to be kind of all over the place. I want to maybe focus more on the entrepreneurial side. And then also, why did you get into the personal finance space in the first place? I know you mentioned that you had a passion for it, but was it a chicken or the egg kind of a thing? Did you see that there was a big acquisition through the website that you mentioned, so you got into it, or were you already into personal finance before the blog started?
That's a good question. I mean, I always was interested, even in college. So, when I was in college at Clemson University, I was literally, you know, using Quicken, the personal finance tool. And meanwhile, you know, none of my friends were like doing anything in terms of personal finance. But I was thinking ahead of, again, there was always a desire to understand personal finance because at the time I would consider my parents weren't really good at it. And I guess the proverbial light bulb went off at that time that I wanted to make sure I didn't go down the same path my parents did. And I was really destined to make sure that I feel most people would either become their parents or they do the exact opposite of their parents.
Exactly.
I mean, you laugh at that, but that's true though. There's no like middle ground usually. And I was destined to make sure I was going to learn about personal finance and learn about investing, learn about the things that my parents didn't do. And that's kind of, I think I always had an interest from college onward and really made sure it was a priority in my life. And from that, you know, again, come 2009, I think it was just the meld of the two that I, you know, knew the tech side. I saw other bloggers like Get Rich Slowly, for example, and being really, really successful at what they were doing. And again, that light bulb kind of went off saying, well, if they can do it themselves, why can't I do it? I mean, you know, part of me was also like, well, I'm not a financial expert. I don't know this stuff. But yet on the flip side, I actually probably knew much more than most people in terms of investing in personal finance. And also on top of that, owning a business on top of that for many years. So I guess with all that said, it just made sense to go down that rabbit hole and decide to. So in terms of a chicken or egg, it was kind of both. That I saw there was not many. Most of the blogs at that time were really about getting out of debt or discussing debt. And honestly, where I was at personally and financially, it was like, that stuff doesn't interest me. And wanted to create a blog that was really more spoke to my needs. And I'm sure there were probably others as well. And there weren't really many at the time investment blogs. There were ones maybe on like Motley Fool at the time still existed or other, you know, sites like reading the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, but there was really no blogs that dedicated itself to investing. So I kind of looked at that as maybe an opportunity as well.
Absolutely. So if I'm putting the pieces together, you started this in December of 2009. When did you end up selling the blog and for how much, if you don't mind disclosing?
I sold it for July 2018 and I sold it for $6
million. $6 million in about 9.5 years or 9 years, if my math is correct.
About that, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So if you had to talk to any aspiring entrepreneurs or people looking to get into a quote unquote side hustle that are listening to the show right now, speaking on your, you know, a decade or more of experience, actually 3 decades if you're counting building the websites and side hustling.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm kind of like dating you here. But
well, I'm updating myself. I mean, it's like I literally, the thing that's funny is, you know, I've been developing websites, since 1994.
94. I mean,
the web was just, in fact, actually I was in college at the time, 93. And one of my bosses interviewed Mark Andreessen. Mark Andreessen, if you guys know who he was one of the co-founders of Netscape. And at the time, he was still working for the NCSA, which is a Chicago-based like college organization. But to make a long story short, you know, that was when the web was just in its infant stages. And I saw the opportunity for the web to be where it was just going to be an economic powerhouse and just change or revolutionize the way we do commerce. And sure enough, it did. So I at that time, really was one of the early adopters to the web and really looked at the opportunities. And even still, even if you say late 90s, I was still early in the game.
Yeah.
And just saw the opportunities that we're still, I mean, we're still in just a, you know, second wave of really e-commerce. And there's still many opportunities out there. So we're not done yet.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because my first question, before kind of giving you that credibility piece of you just being in the game for 25, 26, 27 years since the early 90s, do you still think there's an opportunity to make money online for aspiring entrepreneurs? Or do you think like blogging is dead, side hustles are dead, everything's saturated, right?
Well, I mean, we've discussed this previously. You kind of know my mentality. Yeah, I mean, without question. Blogging's not dead. If anything, it's becoming more and more prevalent because of you have channels like social media. You have if they could literally shut you down at, you know, a moment's notice for something that you didn't even know you did or possibly didn't even do, but yet their AI bots will shut you down because if you're not in compliance, so to speak.
The wrong
thing. In your case, like with YouTube, I mean, a concern I always have is you can definitely do very well with YouTube. But, you know, Google can decide, and it's not even a person looking at it, to demonetize you for without cause. And the thing I think most people are starting to realize, if you're doing anything online with a business, is you don't own those channels. You don't own Facebook. You don't own Google. Or you don't own YouTube. So you got to look at what platforms, what mediums can you own? And blogging and email are still the only two primary mediums you still have control over, ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that if you were, let's just say, 21-year-old Larry, okay, let's go back into the future. What, six Jeez, years, yeah. 7 years? No, I'm just kidding. Exactly. You're going to beat me up next time you see me in person.
Yes, exactly.
So if we go back into the future, early 20s, Larry just graduated, is getting his first big boy job working 8 to 5, and he knows that, hey, he doesn't want the cubicle life. He doesn't want to sit in here for the next 30 years, 35 years, so he can, you know, enjoy his 401k when his knees don't work and his back hurts, right? So what does Larry do when he's 21 in 2021?
I mean, it's the same things that I did kind of when I was 21 or getting out of the first job, is I knew that working for someone else sucks, to put it simply. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's I always knew that. And some of it was based on, I think, my own father and his experiences and seeing what the pains and tribulations he dealt with in the private sector. And I kind of realized that really at an early age and decided I didn't want to go down that path. So the first, foremost for anyone, be it me or whoever, was to decide this is not the path I want to lead. I want to do something different. I want to become an entrepreneur. And it's something that necessarily, it's not an overnight success. By all means, I wasn't. But it's something you got to, you know, look towards your path and say there is a final destination. And what, I mean, if you asked me 10 years ago, you'd be a writer for a blog, I would have laughed at you. Mm-hmm. And ironically, I became an author, a publisher of, you know, a very popular blog. And, you know, so by all means, you have to expand your knowledge set, your skill sets, and look at what's called, Scott Adams does this, the author of
Dilbert.
Dilbert, thank you. And he talks about talent stacking, right? And I'm all about that. To me, you take a bunch of average or so-so skill sets and combine them into, you know, a powerhouse. And you really look at, in his case, he's, you know, a decent artist, a decent writer, a comedic writer. And from that can create, you know, Dilbert and do very successfully. And it was no different for me. I took, you know, my understanding of technology, understanding marketing, my capability for copywriting, and understanding then from tracking as well, affiliate marketing, and made that into Investor Junkie and did very, very well with it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that I listened to that episode. I think he was on the Joe Rogan Experience when he talked about talent stacking. He's mentioned it a lot. Yeah, but he talks about the gist of it, I believe, if I remember correctly. This was a couple summers ago. But you don't have to be number one at any one thing. You just have to be, you know, number 4, 3, 2, and then you stack those things on top of each other, and your end product is still going to end up, you know, among the top 5 in that industry or niche, if you will.
Totally.
So, yeah, I think that's great. And I think just from my experience as a YouTuber, I'm a one-man show still. Everything you see set up here, I set up myself. I did all the research. I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just saying that if you have that motivation and that natural curiosity, I think that you can become almost anything in this playing field with the internet. I think technology is the great equalizer. Would you still build a tech-based business today, or would you go to brick and mortar? I mean, just knowing what you know through your, you know, 25 years of experience.
Well, I mean, in the age right now we're in, with COVID still existing, I mean, to me, it's just sped up the whole process. To me, it was already happening even pre-COVID in terms of brick and mortar. While not going to disappear, it does need to adapt. I mean, even look at Amazon. Amazon's not abandoning, if anything, acquiring brick and mortar and understanding the value for brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. So just like any other transition phase, like, you know, people were all up in arms that, you know, with the advent of TV, that radio would disappear. With the advent of the internet, TV and radio would disappear. I mean, they don't disappear. They just have to morph or adjust accordingly, because each medium, for example, has its positives and negatives. I mean, there's things that can be done online very effectively, but with the traditional storefront, it just can't be replicated. You know, they have done things like, you know, dresses or shoes or clothing online, but it's still nothing beats the experience of physically going to a store and trying on that, you know, a dress, a shirt, whatever. You know, so those things are not going to go away. But I mean, to me, at least I've always liked digital marketing. I've liked selling digital products. I liked being online. To me, it's a much more comfortable fit for me and allows me much more of the digital nomad, you know, online style, you know, that really afforded me to do the things I can do, where I think owning a storefront just is not scalable.
Absolutely. And I think just from you hit the nail right in the head. I was going to get into scalability. Just if you look at like YouTube or a blog, you can reach anyone anywhere 24/7, 365, as opposed to having, you know, business hours, if you will, you know, with a brick and mortar business. The other thing I wanted to talk about was that digital nomad lifestyle. A lot of people seem to be gravitating towards that. My one buddy was back home in Cleveland. He was visiting from Austin, Texas. He works at Oracle, and he's actually going to take, you know, a couple months off and just literally work from, I think, Costa Rica, I believe. And you can afford to do that now. If you were back in early 20s, is that something that you would consider, or are you considered like, are you still the, you know, the family guy, you know, because you and I have
I have a family now, so it's a little harder. I mean, if I was 21, would I be living, for example, in New York? That'd be a hell no.
Yeah. I'm cold right now. I'm in my house right now and I'm freezing my ass off in Cleveland. Like my heat's all the way up. Like, what's going on?
So, I mean, I would probably be living in Puerto Rico if based on the tax advantages.
Taxes, and
the the business options in Puerto Rico. But, you know, with a family, with right now where I'm living, I'm in New York. I mean, I'm looking to pursue an actual secondary home in Florida. Hopefully acquire it next month or so.
Nice.
But you know, our primary mainstay will still be in New York again, because I have a wife and kids. So it makes it much harder to become mobile. So if anything, if you're doubting yourself in your 20s to, should you go out and do, you know, visit various places, if you want to do that, by all means, do it now before you have children or get married.
Yeah, one of my buddies is a YouTuber. He's down in Miami right now. You know, I'm not going to disclose anything, but he's looking at property down there. He's also from New York. You know, he can't stand the cold either. So he's like, man, I'm down here looking for not only for change of climate, but also you touched on this with taxes. Explain a little bit about that for people that don't own a business or don't understand. Just, you know, we live in states. I'm in Ohio. You're in New York. We have state income tax. What is the appeal? Why is everyone moving to Texas? Why is everyone moving to Florida?
I mean, like you said, the weather aspect of it is definitely part of it. The regulation is another. I mean, granted, if you're a digital business, you probably don't have many employees, or if at all, if there are employees, they're not probably even in the same state. So a lot of them are 1099 or contractors. Mm-hmm. But there is something where, in my sale of my business, as an example, I could have literally bought a nice house in Florida.
Based on the state income taxes.
Based on the state income taxes alone, which are expected, based on recent news articles, are going to go up even higher in New York State. Now, that's a whole other topic, you know, we can get into or not. But ultimately, it's state taxes are not an insignificant factor. And it's not, should be the only factor in terms of deciding where to live or where to open a business. But it definitely affects, you know, as far as your decisions and what you do and what you don't do. I mean, regulations and taxes do affect your decisions as a business owner, without question.
Yeah, I see a mass exodus of all these Californian YouTubers or high income earners with businesses. And unless you're in the ultra, ultra wealthy, you know, you don't mind, you'll pay for the convenience or the sunshine tax. But the people that are kind of like small to medium sized business owners, they're reconsidering. They're the ones that are moving to Austin, Texas, or the ones that are moving to Las Vegas, Nevada, and potentially even, you know, Miami. You know, I know Miami's mayor is making a huge push to turn that into the next, you know, Silicon Valley or the next crypto.
He's literally you know, tweeting out or replying to tweets that people are saying, like, I want to move to Florida. Okay, what can we do to help? I mean, how weird is that? I mean, that's very bizarre. I mean, it's great that he's doing it, but it's very bizarre also.
Yeah, I think he's trying to jump on a new opportunity. The only thing keeping me from looking at Miami is I keep seeing these big studies of floods and, like, you know, hurricanes, and it's rising, you know, 6-8 inches, you know, every couple decades. I'm like, I don't know.
We're looking at West Palm Beach, so it's a little bit northern of that, but still the same issues. I mean, to your point, I mean, not for anything. I have a condo here in New York that was affected by Hurricane Sandy that literally was demolished or destroyed. So, I mean, you're not safe from anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, hurricanes happen, climate changes, all those issues, whether you know, you have to deal with it or not, it's a whole other topic, but it's things are, you know, there's no guarantee of anything, be it, you know, tornadoes, hurricanes, what have you, and natural disasters, fires, same issues. I mean, not for anything, California has had major issues in the past year from fires, as
an example. Absolutely. That's why everyone should move to Cleveland. The weather sucks 6 months out of the year, but we got Lake Erie, you got a freshwater ocean, and no earthquakes, hurricanes.
no fires, hurricanes, earthquakes, or tornadoes.
Yeah, it's only cloudy 180 days of the year. So, no, all joking aside, so I feel like we're digressing here. So just to bring the focus back onto some certain current events. I want to go back a little bit into what you're personally doing for your portfolio. Now that Bitcoin is going through another huge bull run, has this appealed to you at all? And you're a little bit of a technologist as well, and I know you like to keep your finger on the pulse. Does Bitcoin appeal to you at all? And then just from a more overarching question, I'm probably stacking too much stuff on top of each other here. What is your portfolio looking like? Do you feel like we're in a big bubble equities-wise? You know, what are you investing in, if you don't mind me asking?
It's interesting. Yeah, as far as technology, I'm not against Bitcoin itself, but I guess the biggest issue I've always had with people discussing Bitcoin, thinking it's an investment, that's always been the thing I've railed against people discussing Bitcoin. It's just like gold or cash itself. It's not. It's a means to store value, and that's the thing that you have to always understand first and foremost with Bitcoin. So I'm not against Bitcoin by itself. Do I have some? Yes, but not by any means. It's nowhere near a significant part of my portfolio. But it's something that I think people construe it as it's an investment, and it's not. So that's the first thing we have to get out of the way. The second issue is that it could store value. And I guess one of the things that it definitely is not a good hedge because of the way things currently are, it matches things like the S&P or any, you know, stock portfolio index.
Mm-hmm.
And it therefore has correlation very much so to those. If you're trying to hedge or do something that's diversification, Bitcoin is not really a great diversifier at the moment. I mean, will that change in the future? Who knows? Maybe. But right now, it really is in alignment with the S&P 500, as an example. So
absolutely.
That's a concern of mine, if you're going to look at it as a hedge or means of diversification. So that's, therefore, in my case, no, I don't have much in Bitcoin. I mean, to me, do I think cryptocurrency or blockchain will be huge in the future? Without question. Do I think Bitcoin itself will be something? We'll see. I mean, you could theorize that if the governments get more involved with it, they want to actually control it and maybe ban it in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be to your detriment, you know, so we'll see.
Yeah.
As of this morning, I was looking at it, was 31,000 per Bitcoin.
Yeah. Janet Yellen just came out and said that it needs to be regulated. So in my opinion, that's either a double-edged sword. To your point, you know, maybe it'll crash it, or at the other end of the spectrum, maybe regulation is needed for mass adoption. But yeah, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. The thing is that I agree with you 100%. What's kind of concerned me as a big yellow flag is that it's been completely correlated with equity markets, you know, with the S&P 500 as a benchmark, for example. That's my biggest yellow flag, just because for me, that's kind of a piece of my portfolio that should be either great savings technology, which inherently it is, depending on where it goes with price and volatility, that's a different story. Yep. The technology itself is sound because I've done a lot of research on it, read a lot of books on it. But the correlation with the equities markets is what is kind of turning me off, because when I look at my portfolio or my net worth, I look at it as a pie. So when I look at my different goals or chunks, let's call it real estate, equities, you know, bonds, cash, precious metals, crypto, whatever, I don't want too much of that pie to be correlated to the financial markets, which inherently real estate is, stocks are, obviously bonds are, interest rates drive a lot of that, as we both know. And to me, that's kind of like the biggest yellow flag with Bitcoin. Because if you look at it in March, it dipped just as much as the S&P 500 did. What's your, you don't have to give specifics, but what are you bullish on? Are you looking at, obviously you're looking at purchasing real estate, maybe not from an investment standpoint, maybe more from a lifestyle standpoint, or what are you looking at?
No, it's definitely, it's an investment property, and I'm looking to add that because I've had the existing property here in New York for many, many years. I've literally owned it since September 11th, 2001. So I've had it for many, many years. It's time to move on. I've seen the growth for that property, and it's time to diversify. I think in this case, not only what state I'm in, but also just diversify and get a bigger property. So it's time to move on. But so I'm very bullish on, yes, on real estate is one avenue. But yet that's to say real estate, it's at all time highs. I mean, if you look at the, I mean, part of it should be said because of the things put in place because of COVID in terms of like moratoriums on evictions and stuff like that. We're now at the all time lows of inventory for real estate, which is just amazing. So real estate prices, I think in the long run, are probably going to go higher, even if we have just moderate inflation. Let's assume, you know, all things being equal, we could, you know, we could definitely see real estate go higher. It could go lower too in the short term, of course. But I think with the interest rates, it was, I literally applied for a mortgage, and that's a 30-year fixed at 2.49%.
That's literally
free money.
Yeah, sorry to talk over you. Yeah, that's literally what my mortgage is. I have a 30-year 2.49 fixed rate. And I'm glad you brought this up because two things. So when you actually sold Investor Junkie, let's just pretend it was literally $6 million in your bank account transferred straight to you.
I mean, it's not, but
Exactly. Just for the sake of conversation, let's just say it's six or whatever. Let's call it five, whatever. So what was the first thing that you did in terms of like the pleasure purchase? I already know what the answer is, but what was the pleasure purchase? And then what was the, okay, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a, you know, brother, uncle, whatever. What were the next steps?
I mean, I bought my, you're alluding to my Porsche 911. So yes. I have a Porsche 911 Turbo S 2015. I bought a used one, not a new one. And I did that just as my pure, like, let's reward myself in some way. In some ways, I was eyeing one even before I sold the business. And I didn't necessarily had to, I could afford it even before selling the business. But again, I was looking at it as like, okay, let me like a specific marker or event to reward my success or sale. So I did that. Outside of that, really not much. I mean, I've been really conservative in the asset allocation where most of it is, I can't say most of it. A good portion of it is in, you know, cash or cash-like instruments. So I've been very short-term in terms of the investments because it's like anything. You don't want to do anything irrational with any big win like that. You want to do something, I think, more methodical and really look at where the opportunities are. I mean, to answer your question before that we were mentioning about where I think the markets are, I mean, I think overall there are a lot of bubbles at the moment. I always like to look at things where the opportunities or things are cheap, and there's not many things really cheap at the moment. And it's hard for me to justify some of the purchases based on the valuations of where they're at. It's very difficult. So,
yeah, I think anyone from a reasonable financial background or for someone who knows how to analyze these things, you know, I've felt this way almost since 2018, to be quite honest. I've kept buying. I've kept dollar cost averaging just because that's what I do. But, you know, do I feel like it's frothy? Absolutely. I feel like a lot of that is because of monetary policy. I feel like it's low interest rates. Interest rates drive everything, as you and I know. So just for the audience, in case they don't know, typically when interest rates are high, the cost of borrowing money is high, meaning that the velocity of money typically slows down, which, you know, drives asset prices down. But when debt is cheap, when interest rates are low, you typically see that inflation in assets, as you mentioned, real estate, all-time high price per square foot. You look at equities, all-time highs. If you look at just from March 2020 till now, we basically went through like a 8-year market cycle in like 8 months, you know?
Collectibles, same thing. Collectibles are all time highs. I mean, look at cars is something I'm very familiar with.
Yeah.
Some of the price points. I mean, I was just looking the other day, a little bit of history. So I owned a 1999 Honda Civic Si.
Oh, nice.
You know, a decent car, I mean, at the time. I was looking at the price points of what people are selling them for now, for unmodified, which was pretty hard to find one nowadays, unmodified. Mm-hmm. They're going for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 with only, say, 20,000 miles on it. This is for, again, a 2000, you know, year 2000 car.
Yeah.
And they're going for above what normally, I mean, the car at the time I purchased it was only $17,000. So they're going double in some cases, if not more, than what the car was originally worth.
Yeah.
It's just insane. I mean, there is demand obviously there, but it's still, I think the markets, no matter where you look, businesses as well. I mean, I'm looking to acquire perhaps other blogs, and the multiples that sometimes are just ridiculous. It's hard to find because of the you know, where interest rates are. It's like you'd have to go up what's called the risk curve and find other assets that are riskier and generate more, you know, interest. And it's very hard to find something decent.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about that a little bit. How was your blog valued when you sold it? And also, how are you evaluating some of the blogs that you're potentially looking to acquire?
So, I mean, blogs are usually, and there's some good things about this and some bad. I think one part of it is blogs are usually valued at purely the amount of traffic you get and the amount of revenue you generate. And the way the revenue is, maybe it could be over per month or 6 month period or a year. It depends on, you know, some people value it differently or do it multiples of either per year or per month. But ultimately, if you do it per year, the multiples come anywhere from 3 to 5, even higher in some cases, depending on the income that blog generates, or it could be on a month to month basis. So you can have, if it's monthly, it could be 30, 40X multiples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so ultimately that's how blogs are valued. And the interesting thing in my case is, and it's something I, in the sales process, discussed, if they're going to look at really a multiple of the business itself and not look at some of the technology I developed, I said, I want to own that technology, and mm-hmm. decided to say, I want to own that technology and then use it for my own purposes.
As you should.
Because which they didn't want to value it. So I said, okay, look, I'll take that and use it for other things, and did just that. So, but that's typical. It's not most people who are looking to acquire blogs look purely at the numbers games, the income it generates, the traffic it generates. And then is there a pockets of opportunity where they can, you know, if the blog is being under-monetized, can they better increase that monetization or can they increase the traffic or both?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really only the two major things that move the needle in terms of valuations.
Yeah.
So that's that aspect of it. In terms of my side, I think there's certain sectors, certain businesses that are more appealing to me than others in terms of niches. Part of it being, you know, I already created a personal finance blog. Do I want to get back into it? Maybe not.
Run my blog, Larry. Run whiteboardfinance.com.
But we could.
Please. I'm spread too thin.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with any. That's the same thing as well. I'm looking at, I actually put an offer onto a fitness blog. Weightlifting, and I liked that blog, but the multiples at the time were just a little too frothy for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. I feel like these websites, I look at it as commercial real estate. The way you value commercial real estate is through its NOI, its net operating income. Basically, where can you raise the rents? Where can you increase the income of the property? You know, if you're self-storage, can you raise the rents? Can you sell boxes? Can you sell scissors, you know, tape, whatever? Mm-hmm. Different services, moving services. That's how you really increase the value of the property. That's the same way that I look at these websites. My brother-in-law, he's really big into that. Basically flipping websites, kind of like you would flip a house. It's more of a short-term kind of game as opposed to building an authority site like Investor Junkie. But I do see the appeal in that. To me, it's just a realm or a world that I don't really understand that well yet. My best and highest use of my time is still on YouTube. How do you feel about that?
It's interesting for my end. I'm selling, you know, services or consulting, and I can't do, per my NDA, discuss my previous blog, right? So I need something that's less meta than here's me showing you how to make money off of you, making money off of you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have a blog that really is a showcase of the technologies or the things I do to increase it. So I'm looking for something to acquire for that sole reason of, I want to showcase it as here's what I did to do X, Y, and Z,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, again, using my own blog. With that said, in terms of what you mentioned, I mean, YouTube is an animal unto itself, which is, you're definitely doing really good at. But I think in the long run, we've talked about this offline, is having your own blog is definitely critical, because you want to have something that, again, you're not totally in control by Google.
Absolutely.
Google decides to say, we hate your content and devalue or demote you or completely block you. You don't want to be, you know, losing a business overnight.
Absolutely.
But that's the thing that a lot of YouTubers, Twitter, Facebook, what have you, have all had that issue at some point.
Yeah, I noticed some of the YouTubers that are less, you know, business savvy, say it's someone, or actually I don't even want to give examples, but just pretend it's someone who's less business savvy. They don't really understand the amount of risk that they run by running their business on someone else's platform or someone else's channel. That's why I try and own, you know, I don't mean this own literally, I mean own my audience through email, through different other platforms that are mine, the website, you know, contact forms, courses, schools, things like that. I feel like once you establish that relationship with your audience and they like, know, and trust you, and you bring them onto your platform, then it's kind of like that 1,000 fans theory, meaning like if you have 1,000 fans that'll pay you $100 a year, you know, you make $100,000 a year, that kind of a thing. So to
I mean, the thing, go ahead. I was going to say, the thing that's interesting is most, like, it's, people think affiliate marketing is great. It is great in some respects, but it doesn't have without its risk. No business is perfect. I mean, mm-hmm. be it a YouTube channel that you do very well at or a affiliate marketing blog, there are risks. You know, for affiliate marketing, they could literally shut down an affiliate program overnight. So you have no control over the products in which you market.
That happened during COVID. There's
totally.
A couple
it happens,
of, yeah.
It happened in 2009 as well. The 2009, a lot of affiliate programs shut down. And you know, with blog, you're a lot, really relying on SEO. So you're still relying on Google at some level. There's no, you just have to realize what the risks are and then how you can, like investing in, like investing in anything, how do you diversify? How do you make sure you don't have one source of revenue or one source of traffic?
Mm-hmm. So if you were starting a blog today, what niche are you looking at? Are you looking at personal finance or is that too crowded still?
It's not crowded. It's more a matter of I've did that, done that. If I was still, I would have never sold Investor Junkie if I really wanted to. I felt I did everything I wanted to do and had to say, and now I'm trying to move on. Mm-hmm. Where I think for me at least, entrepreneurship or helping other entrepreneurs is a better way of channeling my time and effort.
Are you doing that today?
Well, yeah.
nudge, wink, wink.
nudge, wink, wink. Yeah, I have my own blog, LarryLudwood.com.
So what do you do? So this is not a free plug, even though it is. My point is that I'm actually a student of Larry's in his course. Tell us a little bit about what you do there and what you offer there and why you chose to go down that route. Is it more of a giving back kind of a thing with a little bit of monetization, or is this your bread and butter?
No, it's definitely helping other entrepreneurs. I mean, I think one of the things that I've really gotten, well, it's interesting with Investor Junkie, right? I wanted to be much more holistic and discuss owning a business there. And the surveys showed otherwise. People had no desire to discuss owning a business. They wanted to discuss ways to eliminate debt or maximize their 401k or, you know, ways to, you know, do anything in terms of investing, asset allocation. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, you know, while those I wanted to discuss, I felt also, again, owning a business was a really, should be a key part of that. And I think now with selling that blog, you know, I have the opportunity to do anything I want, of course. And I think now it's, I think I just get more enjoyment helping other entrepreneurs with their challenges in running a business and what can you do to be more effective online, since I did you know really well at that. So to your point, it is a means of giving back. It's obviously a business as well. It's not a charity.
Of course.
But it is. With any business, you want to make sure you're at least, I'm not at the moment taking any salary for my own business, but I'm using it as a way to just grow the business and reinvest those profits back into the business itself.
You wrote an article the other week that I loved. I shared it on Instagram. So if the people that are listening to this didn't see it, tell us a little bit about that, how all personal finance gurus are liars. I love that title and I love the message in that video because I resonate with a lot of that.
Well, it's interesting. Someone got the analogy of where I got the source of that title from, and it's Seth Godin. I don't know if you know who Seth Godin is. Mm-hmm. Seth Godin has a book called All Marketers Are Liars. The book is a great book, by the way, but it gets into the whole why marketers are liars. And it's the same issue with personal finance. Their personal finance in general, while the advice they give is not necessarily bad advice, it's not going to make you wealthy. And I think most people think when they're not wealthy, that the way to get rich is invest in the stock market and you'll just get these instant riches. And that's not really... The stock market or just overall investing in passive means is a way to maintain your wealth. It's not a way to create wealth. The way you create wealth is by your job or by your business or something you do actively.
Your income.
And I think most people fail to understand or realize that. And there are definitely better, not all ways to generate income are created equal. There are ways, you know, you can trade your time for money. And there are ways to do it much more where you can scale it. And doing a business is one of those things you can scale. And most people... again, don't understand that and look towards personal finance gurus, if you will, as the means of they have the answer to everything. Yet in reality is they didn't become wealthy by giving out the advice they give is by the businesses they own.
So yeah. Susie Orman didn't become a multi-millionaire by cutting back a couple of coffees a week. That I can guarantee you. So I don't know if you saw my Instagram post on how Elon Musk became the richest man in the world by cutting back, I don't know, 32 billion lattes or something like that.
Well, it's true, though. I mean, people, and the book by MJ DeMarco,
Millionaire Fast Lane or something like that.
Millionaire Fast Lane, which is a great book. he really talks about the fake gurus, and I totally agree in that sentiment. So not everyone really fully understands that process and really say, I'm not saying, again, the advice they're giving is outright bad, but it's definitely not the way they got wealthy themselves. And it's not the way if you want to become wealthy, that's not the way you're going to get wealthy either. It'll make you much more, you know, again, there are many people that have owned businesses that fail miserably with personal finance. So I get that. And that's something definitely I want to help more people with. But in the same notion, it's not how they generate their income, their massive amounts of income. It's because of the business they owned or by the job they worked at.
Absolutely. And I think one of the biggest comments I get, so I have a couple of videos about Dave Ramsey, one praising his 7 baby steps and how it's a good foundation, the other one talking about how he's wrong about credit cards. Basically, his gist is that, you know, no adult human being on the planet should own a credit card ever and never use it ever, right?
He's wrong about investing too.
Yeah, well, that's a whole different podcast episode. We'll shoot that one at the bar.
That's something that you literally could talk a whole episode about how bad his advice is.
Yeah, I think he's like an Alcoholics Anonymous for finance, which is great. And I like a lot of the stuff that he talks about for, you know, everyday person. But it's so funny in that I talk about how Dave Ramsey is wrong about credit cards. And in the comment section, it's either people 100% agreeing with me, and I'll get the couple of Dave Ramsey zealots that say, well, he's a multimillionaire. What are you? You know, it's like, what does that have anything to do with his advice? Like, he sold a product and he scaled the crap out of it through, you know, churches and all that stuff. It's like, what does that have to do with my opinion? You know, so that's the one thing that going back to your article, which I really liked, is that you have all these people on YouTube that are like, oh, my portfolio is $8 bajillion. You know, well, that's because you invested all of your YouTube earnings back into the market. And now it looks like, you know, you're some like genius stock picker, and you're also the product of a 12-year bull market. Like, come on.
I tweeted that the other day. I don't know if you saw that TikTok video of the couple.
Oh,
that,
no. Like, with the Ohio State hoodie on. No, I don't claim them.
Yes. Well, they with the Ohio State, I forgot, I was trying to look up their TikTok account, but they touted how they, you know, went up, you know, the way they were tracking or way they were making money online. Were making money with investing was to literally get into momentum trading. They weren't calling it this, but they were getting to, watching the thing follow up, and as soon as it goes down, to sell. And that's how they made their money.
Yeah, that's how you do it, right? You buy low and you sell high. Duh.
I wish it was that easy. I mean, we would all be multimillionaires.
Yeah, it's funny, man. When I see people that are like, what really gets to me, man, the side of YouTube that is really kind of irking me, and I don't care. I mean, I just produce my own content.
About this. I saw this the other day on tweets.
It's like I got exposed to this whole other side of the algorithm, man. It's like all these penny stocks, all these people are like 19 years old, you know, like I'm not even going to say what I was going to say because I want this to be a PG podcast, but never mind. I'm not even going to go there. So anyway, you'd be laughing your butt off right now. But anyway, like I see these titles with like, you know, caps lock, emojis, flames, you know, 700%. We're doubling up, you know, get the bag. And I'm just like, I get it's like more of an entertainment kind of a thing. I fully understand that. But man, it's like, imagine being like impressionable and younger and thinking like this is actually how you build wealth over time. To me, that's kind of laughable. But
well, I mean, let's use the example. I worked for a startup back in the late 90s called Commerce One. And I forget the exact gains I had. I was able to purchase stocks or options before they even were public and left the company before they went public. So I had fully vested stock options. Mm-hmm. They went public and I sold almost exactly at the peak. It was pretty damn close. And the gains I calculated, I have it somewhere, but it literally was like 1700%, some crazy amount. Like nice. Something that, no, that's just totally winning the lottery. I get that. It's not something you're guaranteed. By all means, people think that, well, that's replicable. No, that's not. That's winning the lottery. That's basically the effect I had for that event. And proceeded to lose some of it or a good portion of it because of the stock market as well, because I invested all the profits back into the stock market. But the point is, you know, that type of thing is like a one-time event. You're not going to see that ever again in your lifetime. I surely don't expect to see that, even with my own businesses. So most people think that's a common event, but reality is it's a fluke. And that's not a process. That's not something you did. That's just purely luck. So I think most people conflate luck with understanding how to run a business and what's skill. And skill really takes effort and takes time. It's something that's, it compounds over years, not something that's a one-time event that you sold in the stock market. That's, again, It's a I win the lottery in that case.
Yeah, the analogy to me is kind of like honing that blade, you know, just like honing it over time, getting it sharper and sharper just through years of, you know, grinding. How do you feel about that one metric that says, like, if you've done something for, you know, 10,000 hours, you're now a master of it? I think that's BS, in my opinion, because I've played soccer my whole life, and I'm okay, but I would never play at, like, a professional level, you know? But
yeah, I mean, I mean, you're better off than most people. I mean, I looked at it that way.
That's like, a good way, yeah.
You're probably a better soccer player than I have, who's never played, or even when I was a kid, I played. It was horrible. I'm horrible at sports. I'll never be a good soccer player, period.
That's okay. That's why you're a pro blogger, man.
I know where my strengths are. I know where my weaknesses are. You have to really understand. I think part of the process is understanding some people are more talented by very nature on certain areas than others. I know I could never be great at sports, but yet as far as technology, I'm very good at it. You know, I'm excellent at it. I've been doing it since literally 12 years old. So you have to understand that definitely puts me at an advantage compared to someone else using tech.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to look at what you're good at, what you're just overall naturally inclined to. And to your point, yes, you know, 10,000 hours will definitely make you better, but it doesn't necessarily make you the best in the world. I mean, there's always going to be someone better at it. I think to a point of Scott Adams again,
mm-hmm.
is really talent stacking your skill sets and taking a bunch of average or mediocre skill sets and combining them to one. And that really makes it much better than everyone else. That's really where you, I think you're, the talent stacking really is what makes you better.
Yeah, that's a huge takeaway. I think that people should definitely, and this is just my opinion for everyone who's listening, I think people need to play to their strengths, whether that's, you know, God-given or nature-given or whatever you want to call it. You know, for example, like you and I could never play in the NBA. We could practice every day. It's just we're limited by...
Even with my height, yeah.
Yeah, I could be, you know, who knows? I could be 6'5" and still not be able to make it. But my point is that my ability to be able to break down information on my own YouTube channel, you know, outline it properly and present it in a digestible format, me speaking and presenting is easier than, say, for example, you know, writing a book. Like, that's not to say that I'm a bad writer. I'm a pretty decent writer. It's just that for me, I'm more natural at presenting and speaking and being naturally inquisitive. And I stack that with my natural curiosity of like, oh, what lighting is good for a whiteboard? You know, what mixer is good for a podcast? You know, I have the ability to kind of like be curious, and those are my two strengths. And then like Whiteboard Finance or this podcast or this interview that we're doing is just a byproduct of that. And I think that once you keep stacking those skill sets, like I'm not the best podcaster in the world. I'm not the best presenter in the world. I keep pointing this way because that's where my whiteboard is. Everyone's like, what is he doing? My whiteboard is over here. So my point is that like, I'm not the best presenter in the world. I'm not the best, you know, podcaster in the world. But if you keep stacking those things and providing value, I think things take care of themselves over time.
Totally.
Cool. So we're coming up almost to an hour. I think we're at about 50 minutes here. I'm going to start to actually structure these a little bit better. But one of the questions I want to keep asking at the more towards the tail end of these podcasts is, what is one book that you would recommend to anyone? It could be business, fiction, doesn't matter. And why, more importantly.
And why? I can go, because I've discussed this on other podcasts. And I think maybe it'll go a little different and probably more in line for what we can discuss. Believe it or not, I'll probably have to mention Atlas Shrugged.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that.
I've mentioned other books in the past, right?
Yeah.
And like MJ DeMarco's Millionaire Fastlane, it's a good book for actionable stuff. But in terms of concepts, and this is where I'm sure people are going to think, well, Larry's a zealot for Ayn Rand and whatever. It's in some ways, it is a horrible book. Let me be clear. So she desperately needed an editor. She needed to really shorten it and get clearer on her statements. But in the same notion, there are definitely things about it, not only could ring true today, what you see happening in society, but there are definitely a lot of philosophical statements. I think you have to, she's such a misunderstood author and such a misunderstood book. So I think you have to understand those things and take it, what people say out in the world, as far as reviews. I think in some cases it's clear after I've read it, that people have no idea what they're either they misconstrued things that she wrote in the book or didn't read the book at all,
mm-hmm.
or both, or purposely trying to say she's about this or that. She's not. So that's one thing. The other thing is, as far as an entrepreneur, I think there's definitely things you can glean from it and understand as an entrepreneur. So there's definitely aspects of the book that if you're really looking to become an entrepreneur, there's things you can learn from it.
Absolutely.
Without question.
Yeah, I think that's a great recommendation. The funny thing is if you go to like goodreads.com and read the reviews on that book, it's either like 5 stars or 1 star. Yep. Like, there's like no middle ground, you know. People
again,
either love it or hate it.
Well, there's definitely aspects of it. Like I've said, it should be shortened. There's a part of the book that literally is 50 pages long and like, okay, just get on with it. I get it. But there's definitely things to learn from it and understand from it. I've listened to it now. It's a hard book to read. I actually had to use the Audible version, which I liked more. And I've read it now 3 times or listened to it 3 times. So it's definitely things I've gotten out of it in the past, I only read it like about 7-8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And most people, I think, read that type of book literally in their like teens or early 20s. And I've read it like early 40s, no less. And it's just very bizarre. Yeah, I'm definitely a late bloomer in that sense. But it's something that definitely resonated with me as an entrepreneur. So that's kind of why I recommend it for this podcast today.
Okay, so the ultimate question here, and this may get into not necessarily political, but just philosophical. What I'm seeing...
Of course, yeah, philosophical.
Yeah, philosophical. What I'm seeing with my like younger friends. So say, for example, you know, I have my friends, they have younger siblings, you know, that's kind of bordering into like Gen Z even, you know, that kind of a thing. Yeah. Some of the Gen Z I'm seeing is like, you know, we're screwed. We need $8 million minimum wage. You know, this is unlivable. Like, what do I do? Like, I want to live off the government kind of a thing. And then you have like other side of the spectrum, which is kind of like, you know, maybe entrepreneur's philosophy. It's where it's like, I'm control of my own destiny kind of a thing. Yep. I already know where you stand on that spectrum, obviously, but how would you have a conversation with like both those people, or at least with the Gen Z that feel that way, that feel like disenfranchised?
I don't know if there's an easy way to, I mean, ultimately you can't, I guess as I've learned over the years, you can't convince anyone. They have to really learn it for themselves or experience for themselves. In the end, if someone came to me saying, you know, why are things the way the world is and not understand it or subject themselves to questioning it, I think is really where you want to discuss then philosophically where you stand or what things to make more sense philosophically. But in terms of just like anything, you can't force a horse to drink. You can't force someone to learn something if they're not willing to. So that, to your point, I think it's really a matter of where they are in their journey. And some people, you know, open their minds and change their viewpoints radically. I mean, there've been many cases where people start off as socialists in their early 20s and realize, well, wait a second, you know, not only do I have to pay taxes and all these things that are not effective or government's not effective on them, but yet, you know, it prevents me from then becoming a better person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people don't get it. You know, it really depends on the person. I think it's really, each person has to, I mean, in my case, it's more a matter of, I always learn to question things and not always accept everything to be what comes out of, be it our political figures or ultimately our leaders, as being accurate or truthful, and really understanding that, you know, I have to control my own destiny, I have to control my own world and not rely on necessarily others. To me, that's usually a recipe for failure.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, my parents are immigrants. They came here from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, I guess. But, you know, they came here in the 70s, man, like born and raised in Cleveland. You know, I've lived here my whole life. I see like the old school immigrants, how they used to do things, and they had nothing, man. They had no handouts. They had no nothing. They would have duplexes where one family lives upstairs, the other family mm-hmm. lives downstairs. And now just in 30, 40 years, we somehow made it, you know, into decent suburbs, you know, middle class for sure. And cool. That's all within one generation. But, you know, I make the analogy of like my wife's grandpa. He worked at Ford 6.5 days a week, 7 days a week, you know, overtime, everything, you know, Cleveland, Ohio, old school, LTV steel, you know, all the Rust Belt, you know, Pittsburgh, Detroit, yeah. Cleveland, a lot of immigrants, man. And when you see that work ethic, that's inherently instilled in you. And the other thing is, I think that with just like community or family, the family unit itself, I think that's a big springboard to success. It can also be a double-edged sword. You can hate your family. You know, you can't
have a bunch of,
yeah, you can't pick your friends or your family or your neighbors, you know, that's the thing. So, but
I mean, you can go both ways with family. Yeah.
100%.
I mean, there's definitely, I love my family, but there's definitely things about my family that, you know, again, like I was saying about from the beginning, personal finance, I just like, okay, I'm not going to replicate them financial wise. I want to make sure I learn from them and become a better person from it, and did so. And again, made that was a goal of mine. So I guess I set out to make those goals of, but yet you can have others that have like these really great backgrounds, right? You know, again, financially, they have everything, but yet screw it up.
Yeah.
You know, they get into things like drugs or just ultimately, you know, throw everything away and do really wrong things. And that's something ultimately you have to drive your own life and look for what you want out of it. I mean, you have one life to live and not let others decide it for you. I think that's really one of the ultimate, philosophical statements in Atlas Shrugged is making really sure that you live the life that you want to lead and not let someone else determine it for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, whatever this is, simulation, you know, God, nature, whatever, you know, whatever we're talking, it's too early in the morning and this is just coffee. It's not like ayahuasca or something, you know, it's not DMT. I think that whatever we're living in right now, you know, I think that as long as you're acting, being a good actor, you know, doing unto others as you want done to yourself, being a good neighbor, that kind of a thing, and not hurting people, I think that you should absolutely have, you know, your ability to lead your life the way you want to lead it. That's more of like a libertarian standpoint or point of view, you know, and I think you're kind of a fan of the Austrian school of economics as well, like sound money. I don't know. I'm probably putting words in your mouth.
No, you're accurate.
Yeah. So I think that with everything that's been going on since, you know, the first quarter of last year, the end of the first quarter last year with the pandemic and all that, just to end the podcast on this note, not to end it on a negative note, but how do you see the country moving forward from this? And kind of as an entrepreneur, do you feel like it's becoming more difficult to conduct business or easier to conduct business, depending on the type of business you run, going back to kind of like that brick and mortar versus digital?
On one hand, entrepreneurs are really well-regarded, well-respected, right? In the overall, like if you look at Elon Musk, you know, well-regarded. On the other hand, people look at towards Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, for example, as these evil capitalists. We got this like double-edged sword. On one hand, they love that they're successful, but at some point, it's the tall poppy syndrome. They're too successful. They must be cut down to size because they're too successful. Damn them. And it's a weird environment. And definitely as an entrepreneur becomes it can be a very lonely endeavor because you're going by very nature going against many others and what their beliefs and philosophical beliefs are. And it's something that, you know, ultimately you have to know that this is either you believe in yourself and this is what you've destined to be done to do, or just ultimately realize that this is what you want to do and be damned everyone else and what their beliefs are. And again, by very nature, we zig when everyone else is zagging. And it's something that you, I guess at an early age, realized that and said, to hell with it. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I don't care. And just as I've gotten older too, care even less than what others think. I mean, I do want to make sure our customers are happy and ultimately care what their opinions are. But to some point, you know, a lot of people, I think in the past year we've gotten a lot of bad advice from a lot of even people with good intentions, forget about malintent. I think we've gotten a lot of bad advice in the age of COVID on various topics. You know, we can name it. And it's just you just got to look towards ultimately what's best for you and go down that path and not really listen to, I mean, that's to say you should listen to experts and what they have to say to some level. But again, they could be completely wrong and or have been wrong. So why, and this is not, again, not just COVID necessarily, it could be any topic. It could be about owning a business. I mean, the mantra most people will say is owning a business is risky, right? But yet, you could argue owning a business, if anything's much less risky than working for someone else, that you can be laid off at any time and lose your job and have that sole source of income. Where owning a business, you can have multiple sources, multiple customers, and not be relying on just one person. So, you know, in the end, I think to answer your question, I think entrepreneurship is definitely something that's, if you really want to do it, you have to really want to do it and not take it half-heartedly and not do something half-assed. You have to really look at it as it's a definitely a different thought process than what most people have.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think I've been a natural contrarian for everything like my whole life, not to intentionally just be one, but I feel like entrepreneurs typically see things differently, whether it's investing, whether it's, you know, rejuvenating a defunct business, whether it's, you know, taking a piece of land and turning it into something, whether it's apartments or whatever, to use a real estate analogy. I think that the people that kind of zag when everyone zigs or zigs when everyone zags, those end up being asymmetric bets. A lot of times those are losers. Could be 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10 times, but the 1 out of 10 that hits, you know, it's a sustainable living. And to your point, I love that analogy. I've heard that before, is that it's more risky to almost be a W-2 employee because you're almost at the whim of that company or your employer, as opposed to, hey, I can bring on 6 new clients this month. My monthly recurring revenue just went up by X amount of dollars. So if I lose 2 of those, I can still cover the nut and live based on the other 4 customers that I have. So I love that analogy. Any last parting words? I know we kind of got a little bit heavy at the end of there, but just for anyone that's listening, you know, my demographic is typically, you know, early 20s to mid 30s, people that are my age, probably all the way up to your age, you know, anywhere from, you know, Gen Z to Gen X, you know, what parting words would you have for them in regards to, you know, entrepreneurship, life, investing, just life advice in general?
I think ultimately don't listen to others and do what you think is the right thing to do.
Love it. Thank you, Larry, so much for coming on to the Whiteboard Finance Show. First episode ever. I was probably a little bit rusty and rambled, but it was easy with you because I already know you. Thank you so much for coming on, Larry. Where can people learn more about you or find you?
You can go to LarryLedwood.com. It's probably the easiest place. And you can find then all my social media stuff as well.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much for coming on, Larry.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Whiteboard Finance Show. To read more about today's episode, visit whiteboardfinance.com. And don't forget to subscribe to Whiteboard Finance on YouTube. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Investing of any kind involves risk. While it is possible to minimize your risk, your investments are solely your responsibility. This show is copyrighted by Zlatic Media LLC. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or broadcasting.